Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone.
David Oliver Cohen with us and Tanner Cohen with us. Actors and filmmakers. They're the authors of White Girl Problems. Guys, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much.
Yes, thank you.
And by the way, thank you for being here. We have a real bond here. My mom's maiden name was Cohen, so we're probably related somewhere down the line.
Some point for sure.
Some point for sure.
We're part of the same tribe.
At least minimally. All right, let's start this way. When you're dealing with white girl problems, what was it? What was the impetus, David, that caused you guys to put this to pen in the first place?
You know, it all started on Twitter, and Tanner was actually the first person to say the words white girl problems, and he put it on his personal Twitter account. He just made a funny joke and then hashtagged white girl problems, and we all got such a kick out of it. It became the talk of the evening, and then the next day we started the White Girl Problems Twitter account, and over a few months we sort of developed a character, and the whole thing went from there, and we wrote a book.
Okay, now, Babe Walker, obviously, is the main character. Now, Babe Walker, female. So how do you get behind the white girl problems? How do you get behind their eyes to be able to allow an audience to experience it? Comedy, whatever the case may be.
Well, you know, we might not be women ourselves, but the people behind White Girl Problems are the two of us and also our friend Laura, who's our co-creator and co-writer. And obviously we have a lot of white women in our lives. And Babe Walker is kind of an amalgamation of ourselves and a lot of women, both older and younger and kind of a few different arenas in our lives. And we kind of have put them all together to create her.
Okay, now, by the way, which I think is really good when you talk white girl problems, get an idea here. Page 156. Obviously, you know, I memorized the entire book here. But white girl problem number 15. I'll eat anything as long as it's gluten-free, dairy-free, low-carb, low-fat, low-calorie, sugar-free, and organic. Realistically, that's really what we're talking about, because if you go through all of it, you're going to find some hysteria, but at the same time, you find some practical, this is what it's like underneath all that.
Yeah, I think the truth is that we all laugh at white girl problems because there's a part of us inside of it. Every one of us has our own little white girl problems, whether we want to admit it or not. And some of them are obviously hyperbole. We definitely tend to exaggerate with Babe Walker. But, you know, we all do now look at, you know, a label and say, is this organic? Is this gluten-free? Is this going to make my stomach upset? Am I going to have an allergic reaction? So, although she's kind of crazy in a way, Babe, there's a part of Babe in every single one of us. I think that's why it's resonated so well, and that's why we have so many Twitter followers, and the book is starting to pick up some steam.
And ultimately, we were noticing that the type of woman who was like who really was so invested in these diets and these restrictions on her life and this type of lifestyle, they were being celebrated online, on blogs, on reality shows, and people were getting such a kick out of them. And we thought that we kind of ought to create the ultimate white girl, you know, to really point out how kind of insane the lifestyle is. Because it was about time that someone like really made a farce in a big way of how we celebrate these women and how we love to watch them like struggle through their horrible lives.
No, what I love is number 14. Yeah, number 14. I miss you unless you miss me. In which case, I'm over you and into me. Bring it. So really, that's a lot of people when you really come down to it. But are we talking about, is this the older woman or is this that younger generation that's into everything and is cool? When I say cool, I come from a place where I don't think I would recognize the women today. If they came back to my era, they would probably scare me the way they are today.
You know, I think, I mean, Babe, the character and sort of the author of the book, technically, of this memoir, although it is fiction, we do consider it a sort of a faux memoir. She's 24, going on 25. So she is a younger girl. She's very tech savvy. She's always on her iPhone, her iPad, her laptops. So I think it's definitely a younger generation that we're speaking to. Although I will say, if you look across our Twitter followers, nobody loves us more than a bunch of moms. There are so many fans that are younger and older moms who are huge fans of White Girl Problems. So I think, you know, we sort of run the gamut. And the truth is, a lot of guys follow us, too. I think a lot of guys know a girl like this. We all know a Babe Walker. We all have had an experience or some story to tell that relates to a Babe Walker-like girl. Everyone knows a girl like this.
Oh, no question about it. And I'll have to change a word here. 1:28 a.m., I love you. 1:28 a.m., I'm sorry. 1:33 a.m., do you hate me? And 1:39, how about poop on you? That's a better way to say it.
Oh, that's a good job. That's a great euphemism. It's good. Better for radio. Yes, you know, this is a girl who's slightly psycho.
Yeah, she's a major psycho.
Yeah, but that's
what we love about her. She's a psycho, and she doesn't even really care that everyone knows that about her.
She's just fun to be around, even if it's a mess sometimes.
Yeah, but if you look at it, obviously it's exaggerated, but you're talking about almost every young woman that I've met, I'm seeing a description in the problem inside the book. As a matter of fact, I would never say Radio Susie's daughter, who is 22 years old, is anything like this. Sure. But and I've met her and her girlfriends very close.
Yeah, I mean, I think all girls like can relate to that rapport that they only have with their best friends. And sometimes the toxicity of it is what makes it so exciting and why you're friends with that person at the end of the day. And we love that. Like, we're obsessed with bringing out that feature of Babe's character.
Yeah, and I know, by the way, in the end result, with the feedback that you guys have gotten, what kind of feedback did you get? I mean, as opposed to what you meant it to be and where people are with it, did it hold the focus you wanted?
I think overall, people are in on the joke. People get that we are poking fun, that this book, at the end of the day, is social commentary. We're looking at, you know, the gamut of women who are on TV and women we see in magazines, celebrities who are, you know, who are writing about their lives as if it's like some horrible experience when the reality is they're pretty wonderful lives. And we wanted to sort of poke fun at that and at the same time sort of shine a light on the fact that although some of these privileged women do have it pretty good, they do have hardships. So, I mean, some of Babe's white girl problems are actually real problems. Some of them are ridiculous, but I think for the most part, people do understand. And if you don't understand that it's a joke, then maybe the book's not for you. But overall, it's been a success in terms of people understanding where we're headed with this.
Sure. And by the way, with the press release, it's really good because if you look at it, like Sharon, movies like Clueless, Ellie Woods, and Legally Blonde, and it moves that way, and you see a tremendous amount of young women in the movies like this, and you sit back and you laugh. Some of it, there's a reality to it, there's no question. But a lot of it, you have to sit back and say, hey, that's the culture today. It's a pop culture, and in and of itself, you have to respect it.
That's right. That's kind of how we feel.
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, I got it loud and clear. All right, let me ask you this. Is there a website we can find you guys at, buy the book, or also, how do we find you on Twitter to jump on board?
Yeah, so the website is babewalker.com. It's Babe's blog, and you can buy our book through the website. You can order it. You know, you can order the physical book, or you can order it, you know, as an ebook on your Kindle or your iPad or whatever you read on the train or wherever you are. And
you can also connect to the Twitter right through that page. So it's really a one-stop shop. Our Twitter handle is White Girl Problem. And you can just go to babewalker.com. All the information is there for purchase of the book, following us on Facebook, Twitter. It's all in one place. You can even read a sample chapter of the book if you want to get into it.
Yeah, but I said what I love about it is, you know, White Girl Problems, you got Jew Boy Problems, you got Postgrad Problems, you got Hipster Problems. I mean, this list goes on. You guys could be busy forever.
I know. You know, it's definitely, this, we've been doing this for almost 2 years, and since we started White Girl Problems, there's been about 1,000 accounts that have sort of copied our format. None have gotten quite as big as us, but it's kind of, you know, imitation is the highest form of flattery, so it's nice to see that people are copying our style.
Well, if they did it with Facebook, you guys could definitely do it with White Girl Problems.
I think that that White Girl Problems is most likely the next Facebook.
Yeah, we're thinking about generating a huge IPO next year, and hopefully we're going to earn as much money as Mark Zuckerberg.
Got it. Hey, guys. All right, listen, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it. I got the book. I think it's great, and good luck to you.
Thanks so much for having us.
Okay, good night.
Good night.
There are so many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there? When there are so many fabulous faraway places to see, why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Cyan, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Way. You are listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Mitchell Weiss with us. He is the author of Life Happens, A Practical Guide to Personal Finance from College to Career. He's an entrepreneur. He's a business leader. He's a teacher also, has owned and operated, bought and sold turnaround businesses. He currently heads his own consulting firm, assisting banks, finance companies, and small business ventures. And he developed the popular course on personal finance for the University of Hartford. And let us say, hi, welcome to the show, Mitch.
Hi, Michael. Thank you for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Mitch, let me lay a base here for what we're going to talk about. I want to go right to your press release, because it really says it all. These are challenging times for young adults, especially those graduating colleges and attempting to enter the workforce, student loans, mounting debt, finding a job, getting health insurance, finding a place to live. Each is a greater challenge than ever before. Students learn many things as they make their way through college, but rarely do they get the kind of education needed to take control of their financial life. Mitchell, when it really comes down to it, that is such a problem today. No one is taught how to, quote unquote, handle a checkbook, handle a credit card, and what a financial life is about. These kids get their student loans, they get into debt, and before you know it, they get out of the university before they go on to whatever career they're in. They're in trouble.
You know, you're absolutely right. So here's an example of that. A colleague and I made a presentation to a group of 100 kids, and they were mostly Well, actually, they were all over the place in the university. They were freshmen through seniors. It was just a large group. And I asked everybody in the audience there if they've raised their hand, you know, how many of you guys had credit cards when you were in high school? And horrifyingly, like 90% of the kids raised their hands. They had credit cards. My colleague almost had a stroke. And then, so I said, you know, keep your hands up for a minute. So how many of you with your hands raised had to pay for those bills out of your own pocket, your own nickels and dimes and dollars when the bills came due? And the hands just dropped. So maybe 10% of the 90% of the kids that raised their hands, 10% of them were really responsible for the debt they incurred. And I think that's the problem with financial literacy education in the lower grades, with financial literacy education, personal finance itself, even, you know, at this stage when they come into college, they can't relate to it. You know, when you and I learned how to read and write and do math, we did it every day. It's not like they said, okay, today we're doing math, and it's November, and we're going to do it again next April. You know, you did it every day until it became a part of you. Personal finance is that way. It's taught as a unit of study, though, you know, in the lower grades. Well, we're going to do a budget, you know, for this marking period, and we'll have a test on it, and then we're going to move on to something else. And then they get to college, and they're being asked to make all of these incredibly important and complex decisions, and they don't realize that. And before they know it, they're in trouble.
Oh, absolutely.
This is it's been a problem, but you know, what's really neat about it, what's been just so incredibly rewarding for me, I was recruited to teach at the University of Hartford 5 years ago. Actually, this is my sixth year teaching. And it's something I'd always wanted to do, and you know, I have the ability now to do this. And as I began teaching the kids, I realized how little they really knew on this topic. So I started teaching in 2007, and 2006, 2007 calendar academic year. When the recession hit and things really started falling off a cliff, we really started seeing how the kids were reacting to this. Colleague and I were noticing this in the classes that we shared. We had more kids calling in sick. We had kids that were really worried. My daughter at the time was in Australia, and she phoned in to see whether, you know, my wife and I were okay as she was hearing the news unfold. But these kids were really affected by it. Their parents, they were worried about their parents. They were worried about themselves. And what had come out of this recession is how little people really knew. You know, how much you could talk about subprime, you could talk about student debt. It all comes under the same heading. It's a fundamental, you know, that they really didn't understand the stuff that they were stepping into.
Sure. And by the way, Mitchell, I think one of the biggest problems that we have with this is, you know, obviously cultures change. You're a kid, you're in a culture. You get into whatever career you're going to get into, it's a different culture. You meet somebody, get married, now you're in a different culture. And each culture has a different definition. It defines you as you're part of it. Money has that same problem. You're 17, 18 years, or better yet, you're 14, 15 years old, you have a definition of money. At 20-some-odd years old, you have a definition of money. At 50 years old, you've got a different definition of money. I think one of the basic problems that I have seen so far is that you get somebody 35 or 40 years old, or better yet, 20, 25 years old, they're living their life with the definition of that they had of money when they're 14 or 15, because there was no one there like yourself to say, take a good look at it, because it doesn't work the way it used to work for you.
Well, you know, I think you're dead on right about this, that in many cases, even as they're older, you're right, they have a younger view of what money is, or they really don't have a well-formed view of how to manage it. And, you know, let's take student loans just for a second, student debt for a second, because you know, this causes an awful lot of hardship for folks. The money is very easy to get, whether it's from the government or it's from the private lenders. It's very easy. You apply for it, you get it, and you take it down as you need it. And what's insidious about it is that you don't have to pay anything back while you're in college. The interest just keeps building. The loan balance keeps growing because you're taking down more, and you don't feel it until you're out of college. 6 months later, you know, then you're getting the first of the bills to make the payments, and you're realizing, oh, my God, you know, what did I do? Now, there's not enough education on the front end, I believe, coming out of high school and coming into college, so that these kids really understand and multiply out the cash that they're probably going to end up borrowing and see how that's going to affect them. So, you know, so an example, sure. Here's a story. I took a cab over the summertime, and I had this young guy that was driving the cab. And whenever I see somebody that's around college age, I start up a conversation because I just want to hear where they're going, what they're doing. It's just interesting to me. And this was a really nice kid. He graduated school a year ago with a construction science major, construction management science. So, you know, he's prepared to go into the world of developing office buildings and hotels and, you know, big projects and such. Well, you know, there's not a hell of a lot of demand for that right now. So he's struggling, and he's been doing a lot of part-time gigs and just cobbling together the money that he needs in order to be able to make it. Now, the good news is, as he said to me, he's able to move out of the house. He's living with a couple of his buddies. They're sharing rent in an apartment, you know, splitting the bills and so forth. The bad news is that he borrowed $50,000 worth of money for student loans,
yeah.
And his payments are $400 a month. Now, that $400 a month, he told me, makes the difference between him owning a car, you know, because it's $200 a month for a lease payment on a car, $200 a month for the insurance, let alone the gas. He can't manage it. So this debt crowded out, you know, something that he needs in his life, you know, can't make it work. This debt itself, I mean, it enslaves you. But, you know,
sure.
more than anything else, I mean, what differentiates, I think, in the approach that I'm taking, not only with the course, you know, but also with the book, kids today, students today, learn differently than we did when we were kids. You know, they want to get in and out of the information quickly.
Sure.
You know, they want to, and they have at their fingertips, they are technologically fearless. They have at their fingertips the access to all of the information in the world. You have to let them go at it, you know, and they want to be able to relate to the material, you know, so they want to know that they could apply it, you know, and have it be for immediate and practical use. That's why I wrote the book this way, you know.
Yeah.
I wrote it, it's designed, if you've seen it, Michael, it looks like a magazine, you know, it's broken up with lots of short paragraphs and lots of graphics in there so that nobody feels like they're reading an awful lot. Even the PR firm, when they took a look at it, go, wow, you know, we thought this is personal finance. Oh, my God, what are we going to do with this? But now we're looking at it, I don't feel like I'm burdened by it. You know, see, let them get in and out of the information. It's written conversationally, just like I'm speaking to you, you know, so that they could take it, synthesize the information, and it's designed in such a way that they don't have to read the thing from cover to cover. In fact, I really don't want them to, because there's no point. They can't apply it. They're not going to apply the portion that talks about houses and you know, and major life events, because they're not up to that yet. That's why the thing was intended to be as a guide.
Sure. And by the
further,
way, Mitchell, wait, let me hold you up just for a second, because there's a point I want to make. Listening very closely to you, you had, you know, mentioned, you know, the student loan, the $50,000. I know a young woman, well, she's not a young woman anymore, but I knew a woman who applied for a student loan, got a couple of $1,000s. This is probably 15, 18 years ago. And one thing led to the other, and she didn't pay it back. So obviously, she still owes. But what happened to her was interest on top of interest on top of interest. And that a couple $1,000s today is almost $20,000 that she owes the government. And those are one of the traps that a lot of these kids can fall into that they don't realize. You got to pay it back, because if you don't, it could triple, quadruple itself.
You know, you're absolutely right again. You know, as an entrepreneur, one of my board members, a mentor of mine many years ago, had a great expression that he used on me when we were raising capital for one of these companies. You know, Mitch, you got to remember that money always has to have a way out. You know, and a lot of people look at when they raise money that they get to keep it. You know, but those people, when you and I invest in something, we're expecting a return.
Sure.
And it's not only that we want our principal back, we want something extra, you know, for that. It's no different than debt. Investments are no different than debt. And, you know, if you're going to borrow the money, you are going to have to pay it back. And government loans, they were never excused from bankruptcy except in extreme cases.
Sure.
And as far as the private lenders, you know, they were successful in getting the bankruptcy laws changed in 2005, which lets them stand shoulder to shoulder with the government and not have their debt discharged in bankruptcy. The issue that I have with that, quite frankly, and have written a lot about and have spoken to students, you know, about, because they're struggling with this, is that the rates that are charged by the private lenders are a multiple of what the government charges, and yet they enjoy the same protection. You know, I come from the financial services industry, and I have to tell you that that's egregious.
Sure.
It doesn't make sense to me. It's not fair.
No, by the way, no question, and they really believe, too, what a lot of these kids aren't taught. If they decide they're going to become entrepreneurs, and an entrepreneur can be someone who is not going to go up to the corporate level because it's too competitive. They're going to go home, get their computer, and the way it works right now, my goodness, with social networking, et cetera, you can be on the same playing field. But they don't. The first question that they don't ask, Mitch, is this: what's my purpose of being in business? It's not just to be in business. Your purpose is your bottom line any way you look at it. And that's realistically something that they're not even thinking about. And if you're not projecting ahead and got a handle on it, you're going to be in a lot of trouble. Now, is this something that somebody automatically knows? Absolutely not. We need to be held by the hand and say, this is how you do it. Step one, step two, step three, step four. Now you got a handle on it. You go out, you make your mistakes, but at least you make your mistakes with a little bit of background with you.
You know, that's right. That's exactly right. In fact, this generation is more entrepreneurial than the generation that preceded it. And they're entrepreneurial not only because the way the world has evolved, it encourages people to be entrepreneurial. It encourages people to pursue their own ideas, you know, to see whether they will work out, but also out of necessity because jobs were scarce.
Yeah.
When I put together the book, the illustrations of the book were done by a recent art school grad. The websites, the multiple websites that I have from my professional side, the academic side, the book side, these were all done by a recent computer sciences grad. And I wanted to stay close to this generation. So I went and got them on board to help me with this, and you know, I paid them as freelancers. That's how they're earning their living until they can find permanent jobs.
Sure.
So you know, even within the book, when there's a section on career development, I'm encouraging entrepreneurism, and in fact have begun writing the follow-up book, which will be Finance: A Basic Guide for Small Businesses and Entrepreneurial Ventures. This is very much needed in very just straight talk, but in particular from the point of view, I think, from the point of view of the financial services, you know, the lending side of things out. The books that are written, the articles that are written today are mostly written by folks with investment and money management experience. And everything covers pretty much the same thing, you know, budgets and good, bad, and
sure.
good debt, bad debt, prioritizing goals on the one hand, and on the other side, savings and investments, compound interest, time value of money. You know, that's great. I talk about that too. But it's the stuff in the middle that I think is critical. It's how you get credit, how you manage it, and how you protect it, and also what you do when things head sideways. That stuff's not being discussed because...
Yeah.
There are very few of us that are willing to go and do that. You know, this is not financially rewarding to go teach. You do it because you really want to do it. I'm not trained as an academic to teach, and perhaps maybe that's why I'm, you know, fairly popular on campus, because I'll just tell them call it as I see it. But these students, these people that we're training to take over for us, you know, in this society, they need this additional background. And it's not because banks are trying to screw them. It's not because the world is trying to take advantage of them. But it really is incumbent upon you to know what you're doing for yourself so that you can make better decisions, informed decisions, and lead a better life as a result.
Yeah, Mitch, let me say it in a different way because I think it's critical what you said, and let me paraphrase it. You can go to school and you can get go through academia, and you can get all of the knowledge that there is. But none of it means anything till you get out into the street, and that knowledge gets to turn into wisdom. And what I'm hearing you say, what you've got in the middle of the book is the wisdom part, the stuff that you go out and you get in trouble with, and you get back up on your feet and you move forward. The entrepreneur, second area here, the entrepreneurs today, the entrepreneurs came from, I'm going to go all the way back to the mom and pops. Mom and pops had great stories. You walked in, they patted you on the back, they knew your first name, your dog's name, and it was great. Corporations came in, and mom and pop couldn't compete with the corporations, so mom and pop went out of business. Corporations were doing fine, and until they went multinational, international. Then they got competitively globally, could not compete with the global competition, so they had to outsource. When they outsourced, those people who didn't stay with them anymore because the corporations couldn't afford to keep them, did what? They went home. They got on their computers. They became entrepreneurs, and mom and pop lives again, but with a completely different mask on. So the entrepreneurship today is extremely important, because if you don't have it, you may starve out there.
Well, there's 99% of the population, 99% of the job holding population are employed by small businesses. 99%. Yeah. You know, half of the economy comes from small business. Half of the GDP comes from small business. Small businesses move this country. You know, and times having been tough have given a reason for young people in particular to try it out on their own, whether it's freelancing or whatever. And some of the websites that are out there are just terrific for this. So, for example, a website I think called CrowdSpring, where freelance graphic art designers, they put themselves... Sorry about that. Drop the mic. They put themselves out there to, you know, with their art, and they bid for jobs that other entrepreneurs put up because they need a logo, they need a stationery design, whatever the case may be. So it's facilitated. It's encouraged, you know, for you to just try it out on your own. I think that's great. I just want to give them the other side of it, the finance side, so that they know how to just manage and they don't lose what they worked so hard to build.
Mitch, I'm totally behind you with that, and I really think what you've got, it's good. And there's kids out there that absolutely need it, because there's a language that they speak, and or better yet, there is a language that you speak. And if they don't speak that language, they're going to be in big trouble. All right, we're starting to run out of time. Website we can find you at, buy the book, get more information.
Right. The book's name is Life Happens. The website is lifehappensbook.com. And there you'll see the links to Amazon and Apple, Barnes & Noble for the book. You'll also see the blog, as well as the links to Twitter and to Facebook, LinkedIn, as well as an email to me. We're going to be selling a memory stick on the site, but we're going to be selling a download on the site probably in another month or so. The book just got published 2 weeks ago. We're going to sell a combination of all the formats for the you know, for folks to buy, whether it's for the Kindle Fire, the Nook, the iPad, and including a PDF. The book itself is an ebook. It has more than 300 hyperlinks embedded into it. You'll go all over the place. And for those that don't have Wi-Fi enabled devices, they'll see a special URL address imprinted in the ebook, so that they can go to a site and download for themselves on their computers all of the links.
Wonderful. And by the way, when you do the second edition of the book, under Life Happens, you should have the subtitle, and Don't Let It Happen to You, A Practical Guide to.
Well,
okay.
Thanks.
All right, by the way, thank you so much for being with us tonight. Take care. Good night.
Thank you very much for having me. Bye.
And a love who's burning like a will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Some of these days you're gonna miss me, baby. Some of these days you'll feel so lonely. You're gonna miss my hugging, you miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me in Rome, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so good, you're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Sarah Seidelman with us. She's the author of What the Walrus Knows. She began her career as a surgical pathologist after graduating from the University of Minnesota, but she found that practicing medicine was not fulfilling that inner those inner longings, so she took 6 months of sabbatical and found herself frequently venturing into the deep woods, where she was able to reawaken her deep connection with nature, recognizing a strong desire to help others. Others forge a deep and a satisfying connection to the earth. Sarah trained to be a life coach with Martha Beck, a former Harvard professor who writes the Life Coach monthly piece for O, the Oprah magazine, then embarked upon a full-time career as a speaker, a teacher, and a coach. She's the creator of followyourfeelgood.com. And let us say, Sarah, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. I bet in your wildest dreams, you never thought you would find what you found.
You're absolutely correct. I know. Sometimes I catch myself this year talking to people about what I do now, and it almost makes me laugh, because if you had told me this is the work I'd be doing even 2 or 3 years ago, I would have said, what are you talking about? That's ridiculous.
But when you come down to it, what is a pathologist? What is a pathologist?
Well, a pathologist, you know, we spend a lot of time at the microscope, sort of staring at patterns and, you know, making the diagnosis of basically our big job is, you know, benign versus malignant, you know, trying to discern and diagnose disease under the microscope, or lack of disease sometimes.
And or what makes something work and what makes something not work.
Absolutely.
Okay, so that's pathology. Okay, so what's shamanism?
Well, you know, I've realized there's a lot of connections. I mean, shamanism
is
essentially this sort of, it's an ancient sort of healing methodology that's been around for tens of thousands of years, and really has, at its basis, it's really about being very aware and taking all the sort of information in from all your senses of what's happening. That's one of the basic skills. And I've realized that, you know, pathology has some real links to that, because you have to sort of take in a lot of different clues sometimes to synthesize a good diagnosis. Just like in shamanism, when we're, you know, trying to, you know, help heal somebody or to look at the, you know, the environment to determine perhaps what's going on, you know, it's the same idea.
Yeah, it's a vibration, it's a frequency, and isn't that kind of an attunement?
I think it is, and I think being out in nature really helps you to tune into, I think, some really wonderful, you know, positive energy that, you know, a lot of us have, myself in particular, had started to live this life where I was, you know, in an office 10, 12 hours a day, and then coming home, and I was really, with raising 4 kids at the same time, wasn't spending very much time out in nature or outdoors at all. And I didn't really realize how deleterious that had become for me. Because when I took this 6 months off and I was able to spend, even just going for a little walk in the afternoon to go 20 minutes outside, it really made all the difference, because I think it helps you to tune into that higher kind of vibration or that positive energy that is out in nature. I mean, that's just sort of a, you know, the tip of the iceberg, but I think there's a lot out there in nature that can really help us reconnect with ourselves and our own passions and what's wonderful about us, what's unique, what, you know, what we have to offer the world. And that's kind of what it is really, for me. I've seen it.
But is that essence really different in a city where everything is crazy at the time as opposed to being in nature? I would venture to guess that being in nature, you don't have the busyness. So it's easier to be able to settle in and notice things you normally wouldn't notice when you're in a hurry to get here. You got to get home. You got to get this done. You got to run to the lab. And all of those things where your time is so involved that you never get to that moment to just breathe and remember who you are.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, you slow down, and it helps you to kind of tune inside into your own kind of that silence within yourself, which being a super high energy person, when people said, well, why don't you try meditation or different things over the years, I always thought, what? Meditation I can't do. But what I found was, you know, walking in the woods allowed me to kind of slow down and really, as you say, kind of tune into that frequency that, yeah, when we're in the city, and I say, even if you live in the city, you can still do this work of connecting with nature. I think, you know, just even smelling the fresh air and, you know, noticing the birds that are around. I mean, in the city, is actually, there's all sorts of little beasties crawling around and flying around in the city if you kind of pay attention, you know.
You got five beasties
but
here.
But I think that's, what's that?
I said I have five beasties here.
You do? What are they, Michael?
Actually,
do you have a zoo there?
Actually, there's seven beasties. There's three big dogs and four cats. So I know about beasties.
I love it. That's awesome.
But also, too, they have their own energy. And if you really look at them, you watch them, they're very interesting. They're very calming. And if anybody thinks that they don't think for themselves, they've never been around them.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I always say, like, if, you know, people who have dogs and cats, I think they are wonderful, you know, like you said, to notice them and watch what they're doing. If you really connect with their energy, it can be a real uplift. But, of course, domestic, like, dogs and cats are sort of still in service to humans a little bit. And so I always encourage people to kind of investigate wild animals because they're living really wild and free and kind of surrendered to their own desires, which I think that's when things get really interesting, when people maybe observe a, you know, discover a, what I call a core beastie, which is a, you know, a wild animal that maybe has spoken to you for your whole life. Sometimes we can immediately know what that is by asking ourselves, you know, as a child, what was our favorite animal? Or perhaps you look around your house and you have a lot of artwork or figurines or something of bears or whales or dolphins. You know, it's different for everybody. But absolutely, I mean, each animal sort of has its, I mean, we have, each species is different, but then each individual animal has its own absolute, you know, consciousness and way it's going about living its life.
Okay, well, there is something, ADD, okay, you got diagnosed with it, and obviously it happened to you late in life, but you worked with the animal totems. Where was it that you found, what targeted you, what allowed you to center or balance yourself with those totems?
You know, I think there is this, well, in the kind of ADD that I was diagnosed with, inattentive ADD, there's this sort of thing they describe, whether you believe in that as a diagnosis or not, you know, set it aside, but
sure.
The idea is that some people have this ability to sort of hyper-focus and super-focus, and I think that my ability to do that, so you can super-focus, which means kind of tune everything out except for what you're focusing on, which I think is what made me an excellent pathologist, and I think that's what also makes me probably good at, you know, tuning into different animal, you know, energies and, you know, maybe nature energies as well, or it just lends my brain lends itself towards that. And I think I found it to be healing in the sense that being out in nature, just I felt a lot better, and I found sort of this joy and this ability to connect with other people through this way. Whereas in pathology, when I was doing that, I loved what I did, but I was really missing that human connection. Yeah. And what I love about in the book, you know, I talk about how humans can begin to kind of potentially heal themselves or get messages from the beasties that can be enormously helpful for, you know, if we're feeling a little lost or we're feeling a little dispirited. There's a magic that can kind of happen as people make those connections.
Okay, Sarah, let me ask you this. Practically, how do I get a message from the beastie? Okay, and when I say that, I'm
okay.
All seriousness, how do I recognize it? How do I know it's there?
Right, so there's three steps. So you first just ask yourself what's on your mind, maybe the last day or last couple days or last week. Maybe there's something, you know, I got an issue at work or an issue with a relationship. Then just notice what beasties show up. And I say talk about this in the book that, like, if you're living in L.A. or New York City or Manhattan or whatever, just notice it doesn't necessarily have to be a wild beastie that you've seen outside. It may be a beastie that shows up on your Facebook page. It may be somebody hands you a birthday card that has a moose on it. It might be some other funny way that this beastie kind of shows up. Just notice which one, it, you know, what it is that's showing up. And then the third step is really to... you might notice what the beastie's doing, and then you might want to, well, you could consult the back of my book where I have about 50 beasties, sort of different manifestos for each one, sort of describing what the energies are. Or you could Google the animal and simply see, you know, what its biological characteristics are or what its symbolism is. You know, is there some mythology associated with it? And see if anything kind of resonates or comes up for you that helps you or gives you some sort of new insight to whatever the issue is that's been on your mind. When I started doing this, I found it amazing. Like, I was so baffled and amazed that it's a wonderful work for skeptics, because when I began, I thought, well, what can't help me? I mean, I thought it was ridiculous. But as I started to do it, I realized, my goodness, this is helpful. And as I began to share with other people, it was just, especially people who I think are very intellectual, very intelligent, bookish kinds of people, which are probably a lot of your listeners, my hunch is, you know, because we can be so feeling like we need to solve all the problems of our lives with our logic and our linear minds. And often, sometimes the most wonderful solutions and the most wonderful insights are those things that come from, you know, the right side of our brains or the intuitive, you know, kind of more soul-centered or subconscious part of our brains. But often, if we aren't tuned into that part of ourselves, we kind of can not be aware of it.
See, when you get outside,
I think that's kind of the...
Yeah, when you get outside, when you get into nature, quote-unquote, there's something that happens there. When you can get into that right brain of yours, that emotional part of your brain, the intuitive brain, you get out there and you get into it because there's nothing telling you that you can't. And realistically, when you come down to it, when you're involved with all these tens of thousands of messages we get every day from radio and television and people that you work with and on and on and on, it's very hard to move into that because you've got all this deciphering to do, and you have to use that left brain analytical part of yourself to be able to survive and to get through the day. You get outside.
Yes.
You're not under the influence of someone else, and you finally get to feel or experience how you think, and it's okay because there's nobody there to say it's not okay.
Yeah, and I think when we focus on, you're right, there's like this cacophony sometimes of messages and signals and people telling us things and we're reading things. I think the cool thing about whether you focus on beasties or whatever you focus on, I think the beasties kind of helps you create this little laser focus on one signal only. And that becomes really powerful if you begin to focus, because it kind of brings you into the moment and it causes you to pay attention. Like, oh, okay, this is a beastie. This is a message. Because otherwise, you're right, absolutely. Like, how do we otherwise filter everything that's coming at us at 100 miles an hour? In some days,
sure,
it's like
no question.
That.
By the way, Sarah, we're starting to run out of time, but one of the things that, and I'm no expert, but one of the things that I've learned about shamanism, it's an offshoot of Kabbalah, because if you really get into Kabbalah, the spiritual side of Kabbalah, you'll find very much shamanism within it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm not an expert on Kabbalah at all, but I have read that there's so many things in Huna, which is, you know, the tradition of Hawaii and many of the, like, the South Pacific islands. And you might, you know, in South America, they're different. But it's sort of like all across the globe, shamanism has been present. And it's just that, you know, the expression can look different culturally and there are different kinds of stories, but at the root of it is really this connection with nature and this understanding that we're all united and we're all connected. And nobody's greater than one, you know, that kind of idea.
I had this great idea, too.
Wonderful.
We're going to create T-shirts, and we'll make a ton of money. Okay, you ready for this? The T-shirt will say...
Okay, I'm ready, yes.
Okay, when you're in love, you've found your beastie.
I think that's true. I think that's true.
Let's see. I got it. All right. Let me ask you this. Website we can find. Website
you can
we can
find,
find
me at, yeah, you can find me at followyourfeelgood.com, and the book is there at the bottom of that, or you can find the book What the Walrus Knows at Amazon, and you can find me on Facebook at, you know, at Follow Your Feel Good is a page there. So would love to talk about the beastie more with anybody who's interested.
Love it. Sarah, we got to go, but thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michael. Good night.
Good night.
I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to What Are We? Thought-Provoking Talk at Dresser After Dark. Adam Leshinsky with us. He's the author of Inside Apple, How America's Most Admired and Secretive Company Really Works. He's a senior editor at large for Fortune magazine, covers technology and finance. He's also a Fox News contributor and a frequent speaker and a moderator. Prior to joining Fortune, he was a columnist for TheStreet.com and the San Jose Mercury News. And let us say, Adam, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Jobs really had it together when he did his creation of Apple. It goes way beyond looking at a computer or the dynamic of a computer. For all of the studies that you've done, if we were to take the strategy that Jobs created with Apple, do you think it would work if we put that into our administration, forgetting Republican or Democrat, and allowed it to move through and run the country that way?
No, there's no way at all it would have worked, and I'll tell you why. Jobs ran Apple as a dictatorship, as a very authoritarian dictatorship. He trusted people to do their jobs. As a matter of fact, he demanded that people do their jobs, and it was a meritocracy. He promoted people who were very good, but it was not a democracy. This works very well for business. You didn't ask my opinion, but I'm not a fan of authoritarian forms of government. I just don't think it would work well to run a country.
But what he did, now, by the way, I'm not saying that it should be there to run a country. Obviously, business, yes, because there's got to be a focus, and there's got to be some kind of strategy that people stay with.
Yeah.
No question, and Jobs had it for what he did. But the training for the management training program, the rest of it, I'm reading your press release here, that the DRI, directly responsible individual for every task, and the top under the semi-annual ritual, and I mean, it goes on and on. But if you think about the strategy and you implemented not not to have an authority running the entire country, which one person,
yeah.
but if you broke down the different departments and had them structured and had them responsible to get the job done at
yeah.
the end of the day, maybe we wouldn't have some of the problems.
Well, I actually, so thank you. I do see where you're going with this, and I will flip over and completely agree with you that if the federal government emulated Apple in certain ways, I have no doubt that we'd have a better government and a more functional country. So, for example, as you say, Apple has something called the DRI, the directly responsible individual, where when there's a task, each person everyone would know at Apple who is responsible for that task. People will say, who's the DRI on that? The government clearly could do, and all companies could do a better job of knowing exactly who's responsible for something. Not the 17 people who are responsible, but the person. Another
yes.
thing that Jobs did very well with Apple as a giant corporation is that he really succeeded in getting this giant company to behave like one company, not 16 different divisions of a big company. There's no fiefdoms at Apple. Jobs wanted everything to be under him. He controlled each budget, not that there would be multiple budgets. And so you could see you could imagine, you really have to use your imagination,
sure.
a United States government that operated as one government, not many governments, conceivably would be far more efficient.
Okay, which brings this question to the table. When you're looking at Jobs, obviously he did what he did and he was the way he was, but he also left a system after he died. So does Apple fall apart, or did he create it with such strength that even if he goes, if those people at the top stay with it, it'll continue on?
Well, this is what I've begun to describe as a religious debate within the Apple community among people who know the company very well, including former senior executives. You'll get arguments on both sides of the coin. I'll briefly give you both of them. Jobs was central to all the major decisions that were made at Apple. And so there is a bit of existential crisis at Apple as to who will make those decisions now, who will have that vision and that creativity to make these very difficult bet-the-company decisions that Jobs made several times over the years. On the other hand, he did imprint his DNA on the culture of the company. The company does have multiple processes of excellence that are the result of doing things his way for 15 years. And the people who are there, including and especially the senior management, have been working with him directly, all of them since before 2000. And so many of the things that Apple does day in and day out, they're going to continue to do for the foreseeable future, and they'll continue to do them well. Just to make one more point on this, Apple, in my opinion, has had the most extraordinary 15-year run in the history of, maybe in the history of corporations. And I think it would be unreasonable to assume that even if Jobs were alive and well, that they would have had another 15 years like the last 15 years.
But I can also see one facet that would cause them to fall apart. One of your bullet points, a system of secrecy structured not unlike the cells of a terrorist organization where walls were off-limit, lockdown rooms, they could get erected around your office for the next secret project. That in and of itself could be its worst nightmare.
Well, the secrecy serves the organization very well in that it keeps people focused, it prevents outsiders from learning what their secrets are. It makes sure that people don't get distracted. Now, this takes a human toll. It's very difficult to be a cell in an organization. At some point, you might decide, you know what, maybe I'd rather go work at a slightly less good company because they'll let me stick my neck up and my head up and get involved in some of the different things that I'd like to get involved in, and I can't do that at Apple. But as long as Apple uses this system and others to create these magnificent products, they're going to be able to keep a core group of people who want to be associated with those magnificent products.
And one of the things I think is fascinating is the dummy position.
So many people at Apple are hired into, they're not told exactly what it is that they're going to do when they're hired. And this is because they haven't been indoctrinated yet. Their managers think that they're worthy of hiring, but not necessarily trustworthy yet because they haven't demonstrated their trust. It almost sounds a little bit like the mafia. You haven't proven that you're in the blood crew yet. So people know generally what they're going to do, but not necessarily specifically what they're going to do.
Adam, what caught you about this? Obviously, there had to be that cathartic moment for you to say, "Oh, I want to get into. I want to write about this." With all of your experience, what was it about this that really caught your attention?
Well, I'm like a dog with a bone, or maybe like the bull chasing the red flag. If you wave that red flag in front of me, I'm going to chase it. And the red flag at Apple is that they don't like to talk about the subject that you and I are talking about right now. They believe, and I respect them for this, that the only subject they want to discuss publicly is their products. They want journalists to be focused on telling the world how great their products are, but not how great their company is, because that's the secret sauce, and it's not worth their time to talk about it as far as they're concerned. And yet, I'm a business journalist, and this is the most valuable company in the world, depending on which day we're talking about it. And so you tell me that you've got this extraordinary company that is not well understood, and that the company doesn't want to help people understand it better, and guess what? I'm pretty excited about that.
Now, by the way, Adam, fact, fun, fiction, fantasy, when you decide, you in the general sense of the word, when you decide to put something to pen, happens to all authors, it doesn't matter what kind of subject matter it is, somewhere within the process of writing it comes one of those moments where you realize a dimension of the subject matter that you weren't even aware of before. Where was that for you? Where was that light that went on for you that you began to understand something that you didn't get before you started writing this?
You know, I knew that Apple was an extraordinary company. What I didn't understand is to what extent Apple consciously breaks the rules of the rest of business the way it does. So over and over, Apple does things differently, whether it's the fact that they're secretive and opaque when the rest of the business world is transparent and open, or at least claims to be, whether it's that, you know, Apple completely repudiates the notion of general management, that managers should be able to be jacks of all trade and do all sorts of different things. Apple says, no, we want experts who can focus, who are really good at what they do. Whether it's the fact that this massive company has essentially one business, as I was saying earlier, one profit and loss statement, as opposed to multiple divisions the way any other company its size would. And so as I went on, and my realization was, my goodness, this company does things differently from everybody else, yet it's the most successful company that we can think of. That's a fantastic story. I've got to tell it.
Now, by the way, the Apple culture, it's really the Steve Jobs culture. And I'm listening very closely to what you're saying. And what I'm hearing out of this is that this culture in and of itself is what killed Jobs. Jobs had cancer. And he waited too long before he did anything that he could have done that could have protected and saved him. And what I'm hearing is the one thing that Apple didn't have was trust for anything that they couldn't put their hands on and know that it was going to go left, right, and 2 feet in front of you before anything happened. And that sounds like what Jobs did. He didn't trust the way that they were telling him he could get cured. And by the time he decided to possibly do it, it was too late. So it was his own philosophy, I think, killed him.
Well, I'd just say that, you know, I've read Walter Isaacson's biography as carefully as everyone else has, and I would just caution you not to get carried away on this notion of what killed him. I mean, first of all, he lived for, I think, 8 years with this cancer. I would assume, and I'm no doctor, that it would have killed him anyway. So we can conjecture about whether or not his hard work made him more ill, or whether or not his hard work gave him a goal and gave him a very strong desire to continue living. I think we might be on safer ground to suggest that life at Apple is so stressful that it can be unhealthy for certain employees, for many employees. I wouldn't necessarily make that same connection, though, with Steve Jobs. I think Apple was a life force for him.
Okay, but in the stress and the philosophy, by the way, just off the top of my head, I'm listening very closely, and you create a company, you write a book, you do whatever the case may be, and you've got to become that. You have to live it and be it, if you're going to express it in any way, shape, or form. So Apple was Steve Jobs. And I would venture to guess if you look very close into this, getting away from the secretive stuff, and et cetera, that's a talk, you're going to find something about yourself in here. I'll bet any amount of money that as you were doing this, you recognize something about yourself deep within it.
Well, I can tell you exactly what it was, and I'm not sure that it, I recognized myself, but I recognized the contrast with myself, and that's why I think my book will be of interest to people as they think about their careers. Apple stresses that its employees focus, right? So they are not multitaskers. They come in and they work at their task all day long. They're not They are discouraged from joining outside organizations. Senior executives typically don't serve on boards of directors. They don't work on 17 different initiatives or committees. They focus on one thing. As a journalist, I'm a multitasker. I'm always doing all sorts of things. And as I was researching the book, it was humbling because I realized, my God, think of the advantage that I could have if I just focused on one thing. Now, my position doesn't necessarily allow me always to focus on one thing, but I sure recognize the difference now between the way I operate and the way your typical Apple employee operates.
No, I hear you loud and clear. We're starting to run out of time. Adam, do you have a website we can find you at, buy the book, and get more information?
Yeah, my book's for sale everywhere, including the e-book and the audiobook, which I recorded. And you can go to my website, adamleshinsky.net. It's adamleshinsky.net for all the purchase information.
Wonderful. Adam, if anybody missed it, it'll be up on our website. So, hey, by the way, thank you so much for joining us today. This was great.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. Great discussion.
Take care. Good night.
There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there, when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Diana Denholm with us, Dr. Diana Denholm, PhD, the author of The Caregiving Wife's Handbook, Caring for Your Seriously Ill Husband and Caring for Yourself. She became a board-certified medical psychotherapist following her doctoral studies at the University of Connecticut. She's been a practicing therapist for over 30 years now. Diana, hi, welcome to the show.
Well, good evening. Thank you so much for having me join you.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. The book in and of itself, The Caregiving Wife's Handbook, this is not something that somebody is prepared for, is ready for, has any idea what to do with, and if you're not strong enough, it's going to cause you to fall apart. where was it for you? And I know you took care of your husband, but where was it for you? You really decided that this has got to be put to pen, and there's got to be a roadmap for other people in a similar situation.
I think that, well, he was ill for 11 years that I was the primary caregiver. And during that time, I also spoke with other caregivers. Eventually, they were women who I interviewed for the book, and noticed that so many of us were having the very same kinds of problems. I had the skill and training to be able to handle these more than others, and yet I was still having difficulty. So I figured, you know, if I'm having all this difficulty and these problems are common to everyone going through this, then I need to put something down on paper once I figure out how we can make this an easier process. So that was the impetus.
Yeah, that's probably never going to be easy, but I think one of the most important things lacking, and I'm not a clinician, but one of the most important things lacking in a serious condition like this is the support system. When you don't know, where do you go? And that's really a rhetorical question. There isn't any place to go if you don't know where to take that first step.
That's absolutely true. And there are organizations, and in the back of my book, I have a resource section, but unlike most resource sections, I teach people how to use the computer to find information. So many resources are out of date very quickly, so I literally walk people through step by step. This is how you go online and find the information that you need, because there actually is a lot of support out there. One organization in particular, the Well Spouse Association, is the only peer-to-peer organization that is non-disease specific, but it is established specifically for a spousal caregiver, whether it's a man or a woman.
I think that's extremely important, because just looking at some of the things that the both of you went through, I can't say he went through it, because if he went through it, so did you. And I think that's really what a lot of people don't get, that if their spouse, man or woman, if their spouse is going through anything like this, they both got the problem, because you both have to live it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Your husband had colon cancer, had about a 20% survival prospect, and then all of these other things happened to him. He needed dialysis, severe osteoarthritis, frequent bouts of gout, chronic urinary infection. I mean, the list goes on. That must have been really tough to be able to deal with. And I guess the real question is, Diana, how did you survive?
Well, I created methods as I went along. He actually had a heart transplant and Parkinson's in that big list of things wrong with him. And the main thing that I came up with for people to be doing is communicate. And in the book, I teach ways to come up with the things that you need to be talking about, because you need to establish expectations. We tend to jump in and figure, well, this is the way something should be done, or, well, I'll be in charge of that. But we really need to sit down with our spouse and establish the expectations. And in the book, I teach people how to come up with a list of things to discuss, and then how to broach that conversation so it's going to be productive. You know, we never want to start with, we need to talk, because that one's a red flag to most people.
Sure.
Rather, honey, I have some concerns about your care and what we want to do during the rest of your life. You know, could we sit down and talk about that? So a different approach to it. And then once those things are established, we can actually put some of them in writing and have an understanding that we can go back to and review and modify as things change. And in doing that, we all will start to know what's expected of us.
Oh, and I would look at this, you know, the part of some of the things in the book, handling the difficult emotions, the anger, the guilt, the annoyance, the grief, the stress, the resentment, because once the diagnosis happens to the partner, life as you knew it does not exist anymore. And when you're really dealing with it, that person who's the caregiver, the anger, the annoyance, and the grief going through it, then half the time they can't show it. And I would go back to a lot of the guilt. If you feel, if you have any of the anger, any of the resentment, any of those things directed at that partner of yours, it's not going to be an easy thing to do, considering that they can't help it and they are totally at the mercy of whatever those physical and emotional impairments are.
Yes, and if you do not do something about the anger, and again, I give methods in the book, but if you don't do something about these very strong emotions, they are going to spill over into the care of your loved one, and you can have some very dire consequences.
Oh, no question about it. And I wonder how many, not a number, but rhetorically, and I wonder how many people who can't deal with this, they're suicides. There are people who just can't deal with it, and the easy way out is to finish their life. So there's a tremendous amount of things that we really have to look at. And who said that that other person, the caregiver, quote unquote, has the emotional strength to begin with, that base, that core, to be able to deal with what's coming? And most of it is an unknown.
Correct, because any illness comes within the context of an existing marriage. So whatever strengths and weaknesses you had before the illness, that's still what you're dealing with once the illness starts. And, of course, we had the extreme tragedy with the Paul Gilkey murder and suicide, where he was so distraught about the care of his wife. And he was trying to determine that he would be in charge of certain things. And for instance, he killed his two sisters-in-law and his son over the issue of he wanted to feed his wife tea and toast, and they wanted, I'm sorry, just the reverse. They wanted to feed his wife tea and toast, and he had already peeled an orange for her. So he shot these people to death and then eventually killed himself. So that is the extreme. What he
sure
brought into that relationship was that previously he had been a convicted murderer, so it certainly is the extreme marital situation. But when you look at the very tiny little incident that it took to precipitate that, that tells you how serious these matters can be and specifically why communication is critical. You have to establish these expectations, and then the stress level is going to drop.
And by the way, when I was talking suicide, I was talking about the caregiver, because then you
yes,
go with your points here. Also, the things that we don't talk about, the loved ones, hygiene, sex life, relationships with relatives, hygiene in and of itself. If you have to clean somebody up, they become a baby, and they take on a completely different identity from who they were when you fell in love, you got married, and all of the other stuff. Now it's something different. They are somebody that you have to take care of and wipe up after they go. And there's a lot of people who cannot deal with that.
Yes. Marriage, you know, as we knew it, does change quite quickly because often the spouse has to turn into the parent. But in regard to the suicide rate for husbands caring for wives is much higher than it is for women taking care of the men. And the divorce rate is also higher. I believe the statistics are that in general, when there's a caregiving situation, that about 20% of those marriages do end in divorce. And it's because people, you know, are not equipped to handle it. They didn't, even though they have their marriage vows in sickness and in health, they really didn't buy into the thought that they were going to have to be wiping up and taking care of the hygiene and things of that nature, which also hits into the intimacy in the relationship. You know, there's sex and there's intimacy. There's both facets of it where if one moment you've been cleaning up the person's body, then you really probably are not all that interested in being sexually involved with them the next minute.
Yeah.
So that also becomes a very controversial topic in a household. But again, it's one that can be discussed, and you can come to resolution on, you know, how is this going to be handled?
Now, by the way, there's another area of consideration. I know it's major for you, the six-step communication strategy for the caregiving wife. But communication in and of itself is not necessarily just a word, because when you're dealing with communication, you're dealing with an entirely different language. And when this happens to a family, the language changes, the meanings of things change, and if you're not very careful, you can be speaking the English language, and the way they're hearing it could be totally devastating and destructive to anything you're trying to accomplish.
That's true. And I give communication tools. One of them is literally to speak in their language. If they are a person who uses the, well, I think this or I think that, then you want to use that same kind of wording with them. You know, well, how do you think we should take care of this problem? Do you think this would be a good idea? Or if they're using feeling words, or I hear, or I see, if they're visual, we need to speak to them in their own language if we're going to communicate. Otherwise, it, you know, it's the same as speaking Russian to somebody who would not understand it.
No, absolutely, and no question about it. So it's not so much what you say, it's what they hear and in the way they hear it. You know, if you break down language, you've got the definition of a word, you've got the underlying meaning, the subtext, but you also have the state of mind of the receiver, which is extremely important. You can say the same thing. You walk into a room and somebody's in a good mood and say, boy, you look good today, and they say, thank you, wonderful. You walk into the same room when they're not in a good mood and they've had some problems, and you say, boy, you look good today, and you know, what do you mean by that? And the fight is on. So it's very important. It's critical in the way that communication is delivered when you're dealing with somebody like this.
Absolutely. And one of the things that I have the readers do is to go through a list of about 24 concerns where they can finish the statement, you know, I'm angry about, or I feel guilty about, or what am I supposed to do about, so they can think ahead of time of what they want to speak about. And then I have people sort their responses. Of course, that particular list no one sees except yourself. And then you sort your responses into things that you might say but don't expect a response to. And that might just be to, you know, to tell your spouse how difficult it's been for you and how you really do love them, even though you might get a little edgy at times. There are times where you're on your list, you're going to have the things that you want to say but won't because it won't make a difference, you know, such as telling a gentleman to put the toilet seat down for 10 years and that it never worked, so you can stop doing that.
Sure.
And the things that you should only share with a friend, you know, you spoke of the hygiene and, you know, you're wiping the person, you're cleaning them, you're cleaning their catheter bag, you're changing tubes and piping and doing all this thing to the body, and it can be downright repulsive, but you don't want to say that to your loved one, but you can share that with a friend so that you don't hold that inside, because if you hold that inside, it's going to build up.
And no
then
question.
You come up with your, I'm sorry?
Oh, I said no question about it. I was agreeing with you.
Yes. And then you come up with a list of the things that you really need to talk about or know about or want to resolve and make a decision about. And then you start to prepare yourself learning some very simple communication tools, which I have in the book. Language is one that you mentioned. Using I statements. I mean, it's my need. It's not his need to talk. So I'd like to talk to you. And then to prepare yourself before you have this discussion, just as you were saying, you know, you can walk into the room one day and tell a person they look terrific, it's going to be well received, but other times it's not going to be. So you prepare yourself so that you are in a very comfortable position and that you're going to be compassionate. So when you have this conversation, it will work. And I suggest people actually put this little piece of paper in front of them that says, before you speak, ask yourself, is it kind? Is it necessary? Is it true? Does it improve on the silence? That will set you up for having a compassionate discussion with the person. And then you can come up with some framework for your agreements. And once you have those agreements, a lot of the arguing in the house is simply going to stop. A lot of your stress is going to stop. And we will have less circumstances where people will feel out of control and need to cause harm to somebody else or to themselves.
No question about it. And I really believe if you really come down to it, it's a learning process. You go through the years, you learn to be a certain way, and then all of a sudden life gives you something so completely different that nobody taught you to deal with this. You've never been exposed to it before. And quote unquote, you don't know what to do. And that is scary for a tremendous amount of people. And they don't want to say that to anybody. And they hide it. And because they hide it and they stuff it, the problems start with that person that you're going to have to do caregiving with.
Absolutely. And as the Mental Health Association says, it's okay to get help. You know, whether that help is therapy, whether that help is talking to a friend, whether that help is accepting actual tangible help from people who want to come in and do some things for you, help maybe that they will take you out for lunch to give you a respite break. Because as you go through this, I mean, during the 11 years that I went through it, I was constantly learning new things, even up to the very last days of my husband's life. I learned some new communication tools right during that time, which I share with people. And one important one that I learned was that we need to say the loving things to our spouse. Now, that sounds, you know, very Pollyannish, particularly when you're really annoyed with them and, you know, they've made a mess or they've been disagreeable or they've ruined your life or whatever the case might be. So I suggest that if you have to, go outside and say the things where he won't hear them, and these are the nice things. Or, you know, wait till he goes asleep and then say the things. Because, you know, if you're so angry that you just can't come out and say those things to him face-to-face, those very nice, loving things, because you have so much anger, at least say them. Because there's going to be a day that will come when you lose that opportunity.
No,
so that was one of the very last things that I learned in the very last days, that it's important to say those things while you have the chance. I had the gift of knowing pretty well when my husband would pass away. He decided to go off dialysis, and we knew he had 5 to 10 days to live, and he passed away after 5. But most people don't know when that end is going to come. So we need, even, you know, if we're so angry and, you know, the next morning he wakes up and he's a jerk once again and just, you know, is mean to you and annoying, at least you will have said those things, you know, even if it's sitting out in the backyard where he won't hear it, you'll have said them.
And then there doesn't have to be any woulda, coulda, and shoulda, and then, in essence, your complaint. Because it's in you, it's not within them, that this has to come out.
Correct.
Yeah.
And you will feel so much more peace if you'd said it. Because so often the coulda, woulda, shoulda, oh, you know, I wish I really had said these wonderful things. You know, all of my anger was really just because I was so frustrated and couldn't handle it. Well, this way you will have said it and you will have that peace. And that is worth a lot.
No question. Diana, we're running out of time. Can we get a website that we can find you at and buy the book?
Yes, it's www.caregivingwife.com. Caregiving Wife is one word. And you find all sorts of information, including where to purchase the book. Thank you.
Wonderful. By the way, thank you so much for joining us. And there's so many people in this situation that just don't know which way to turn. So maybe more and more people will know that the book is out there and effectively somebody can hold their hand and take them through it step by step. And thank you so much for being here tonight.
Well, thank you so much for having me as a guest.
Take care. Good night.
And a love who's burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, from now and evermore. That's all. That's all. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be
glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back on Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Dr. Horace Woodybrock with us, one of the world's foremost economists and the author of the new book, American Gridlock, Why the Right and the Left Are Both Wrong. And we're going to talk about some solutions and maybe some economic crisis. More than 50 leading chief executives, academics, journalists, and investors endorsed the book, published in January 2012, just this the last month, and by Wiley and Sons. And let us say, Woody, hi, welcome to the show. This is a subject that needs to be addressed every day in every household.
Well, thank you. Good evening. It's nice to be with you.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, when we talk about economic conditions, we're in a situation whereby I think administrations, and by the way, administrations come and go. It doesn't matter which one is in power at the time. They come and go, presidents come and go, but what seems to stay constant is business. Business stays focused, and they're loyal to one thing, to making money. Where do you think we got off track and we got away from the care of the culture as opposed to the garnering of dollars?
Well, I'm not quite sure it's that simple. I think that business does go on. We always garner dollars. We still do. What's happened is government itself has gone off the track. There was a time when 5 o'clock in the afternoon came, friends who were Democrats or Republicans would go to the same restaurants in Washington. Now,
sure,
they never do. They're completely separated. We have gridlock, and that's why I wrote the book. The American public recently in the Pew Foundation poll expressed the view that gridlock, inability of anything to get done in Washington, is the public's number one concern. I think it's politics that's gone off the rails, not business.
Yeah, absolutely. By the way, we're on the same side of the table with that one. I really believe if we really come down to it, if we would look at government this way, if we were all part of government, you come to the table, you come values neutral. You're not a Democrat, I'm not a Republican, or reverse that. Nobody carries baggage that's attached to it. We're here to do construction, and I think, but the problem is most debates are about right and wrong, and that's not really where we should be. So it's a building process, leaving all the gotchas at the door and working on the old ideas, etc. I think that's really where the problem is, and it's at the expense of someone. That's what's critical. It's not the be-all, end-all, but at the same time, we're not doing that. It's who's right, who's wrong, and who gets hurt? You and I, the constituency.
Well, I would agree with that, and I'd say it's not just about, frankly, right versus wrong, but about right versus left. I mean, left-wing, right-wing, New York Times firing cannonballs with Wall Street Journal every day, MSNBC versus Fox. I think the American public are insulted by this. When I was young, we had journalists, great journalists, like Walter Lippmann. They took you with them on a learning process. They were trying to understand complicated things. They didn't say that you were an idiot because you didn't agree with them, which is essentially what's being said today. And I think that the answer to your question here is that what we need to do, or first of all, which I tried to do in American Gridlock, identify the major challenges of the country. I see them as five. Then you have to say, can you identify solutions to these problems that don't cause the left to be screwed or the right to be screwed, but rather that there can be win-win policies that transcend the left-right shouting match, what I call the dialogue of the deaf. And the point of the book is to say, here are the problems, and the good news is there are win-win answers to every one of them. So there is hope. We can break gridlock.
But what stops the gridlock? I agree with you. There are answers. Economically, where we should be, we're not. I think the average person can sit back and see where we shouldn't be spending money. Some of the decisions that are made shouldn't have happened in the first place. But the key is, what's that underlying theme that stops it all? Is it control? Is it power? Is it all of those things that we weren't at what time that we're moving into now?
What stops it, what breaks gridlock, is number one, the identification of policies that actually will solve the problems and that are not left-wing or right-wing. That's the most important point, because if you can't show the existence of policies that are win-win, then it's just going to be a continued shouting match between the thing The second thing you need, after having shown that good policies do exist that aren't left or right wing, is to get the media to develop what I call a new game of gotcha. You know how we go after politicians for their financial and sexual peccadilloes to find out what they've done wrong? Well, I want a new game of gotcha where we look at the idiocy quotients of politicians, where the media hounds them for, in taking a position, how much is that going to cost your grandchildren's living standards? We have to raise the debate in this country and hold the politicians accountable. You're talking about the economy being in trouble. You ain't seen nothing till you look at things like $50 trillion of unpayable medical and Social Security bills in 30 years. These are the good times. So this is a problem not about how to just get the economy going now, but how to solve our really big challenges in the future.
No, I'll give you one of the prime examples of what's stopping a lot of it, because there was no consequence behind it. Not left or not right. I'm going to take Nancy Pelosi for a moment. The comment, the famous comment of, don't worry about what's in it, sign it and you'll find out afterwards. Where in the entire political world, in the realm, has anybody got the audacity to say that unless they have the power behind them to realize they can say anything they want, they're going to get what they want anyway? See, there's where I think the problem is. It's gone beyond consequence for their actions. There's a euphoria that happens when someone is in politics and they're there for a long time. That's one of the problems, Woody, I think, that we have when it comes to our elected officials today.
Well, I think you're right about that to a certain extent, but I would simply say, wait a minute, what's changed? That was always true to a point. But the Roman emperors knew perfectly well what you've got to do as a leader who wants to solve problems, which many Congress people don't. The leader goes to the people. And what the American people want to hear is, there are answers. If we do A, B, C, D, your children will live better than you do. If we don't do A, B, C, D, they will live much worse. Now you get on the phone, you call your Congress people, you tell Nancy Pelosi, we're tired of all the shenanigans, we want action. A leader can do that. That's been done many times in history, in war and in peace. But we have no leader in the White House. Not now. Not really for quite a while.
And by the way, Woody, let me stop you just for a minute. I think one of the biggest problems here, which is at the base, the cause of the entire thing, we have gotten to a point where we are going to vote for who's going to give us the most. Who's going to give us the most candy, quote unquote? Two months ago, there was an African American woman standing naked on top of her stairway in New York, screaming and yelling that she's not coming down until Barack Obama does what he said he was going to do. He was going to pay her rent and he was going to feed her. All right, we know those things aren't going to happen, but when you got a population that is so immersed in entitlement that if they think somebody is going to give them something, they're going to go out and vote for him. There, I think, is where some of the problem is. I would love if we would stand up and go to our elected officials, because they're supposed to be a reflection of what you and I want, and tell them what we want or we're not going to vote. Too many people are frightened to death because of what they think they won't get if they don't vote for these people. I think that's what Obama's doing right now. He's promising, and he's doing it in such a way that he's being believed, even if it doesn't have any oomph behind it.
You're right, and might I add, this began under the German Chancellor Otto von Bismarck in the elections in Germany of around 1877, who introduced the idea of Social Security and said, we're going to beat the left wing at their own game by making promises. And we've been doing that ever since, largely because the extended family died out, so people used to rely upon the clan when they were sick or elderly or young, and now we have to rely on government. But the American people, as Oprah Winfrey pointed out in one of her last broadcasts, have caught on to the fact they know that these benefits can't be paid. Young people show that they believe it's more likely they'll see a flying saucer than that they'll get a Social Security check. So the tide is running out on this business of promising ever more, but forgetting that there is another answer to this. Take the biggest financial problem in your future, the $35 trillion unfunded Medicare, this liability, the fact that we have all these bills we can't pay.
Sure.
You don't have to get government officials to say, we're going to renege on that. We're not going to give you the benefits. It's a theorem you can prove mathematically, which is done on the back of this book so no one will see it because the editors wanted it, that you can still have wonderful medical care for everybody, provided that you increase the supply of medical services faster than the demand. The Obamacare legislation only focused on access and promises. It did nothing about more doctors, more automated systems, and Walmarts that you can go to for $4 in the morning and get expert treatment. So there are answers, good answers, and it irritates me that we're not pursuing these things, which are not political.
No, and by the way, it comes back down to power, and it comes back down to money. And if you look at the Obama administration, and you go back to Germany right before the Second World War, what was going on? They were confused. They were in an economic situation. They were fighting to death. They didn't know what the next step was. Hitler came in, and he gave them identity, which is happening to a lot of people here. He nationalized healthcare. He nationalized the banks. The list goes on, the schools, etc. You see the same thing going on here. So I think everything you're saying is spot on. I would be standing with you to do this and get this done. But somehow we have to move beyond the challenges that we're facing and get people to actually see that what they're getting promised is going to cost them big time down the road.
Well, I think that, they're beginning to know this on their own. Oprah Winfrey, once again, caused a sensation when a lady asked Oprah, is it true that Jimmy and me won't be able to retire at 65, and we may have to work to 67 and 68? You know what she said? She said, try 74 if you're lucky.
Sure.
Americans are in trouble. They know they don't have money for retirement. They know these problems. Again, I agree with what you're saying, but I want leadership. And leadership that says, better times lie ahead if we do ABC, and terrible times lie ahead if we don't. No one is telling the American people that. Obama talks about hope and change, but name any concrete policies that he's delivered that says we'll make you better off tomorrow. Virtually none.
No, and do you see anybody in the Republican side that has the strength to do what you're talking about?
Well, again, it's addressed in American gridlock, exactly that point. The answer is not much for the people who are running right now. But once again, like the point I just made about the fact that you could have your cake and eat it, too, more universal coverage in medicine and a bill half the current size by letting the supply increase faster than the demand, which is a very important point. They don't know that. So when I say, do I see somebody coming down the pike who can do these things or talk about them, neither side understands that point, nor do they understand the fact that you could have a Marshall Plan, which is what the economy needs tomorrow morning, where you do borrow and continue to borrow, but the government doesn't spend the money wastefully on transfer payments. Rather, it invests in profitable projects to pay for themselves. So the bond market's happy that the government is borrowing. The interstate highway system, we borrowed for that. It had a 13% rate of return on capital over 40 years. It made a fortune for the government. We need a Marshall Plan now.
What you're saying about supply faster than the demand, absolutely. If the supply is faster than the demand, if it's a greater supply than the demand, the costs go down. That's
not
what's
critical. Not just the cost, it's better. It's that the total expenditure on healthcare as a share of GDP, now 18.3%, under Obamacare in 30 years, 35%, I show can go down to 10%.
Yeah.
But they did nothing to increase supply. 25% of doctors are about to retire in the next 22 years. Harvard Medical School doesn't produce any new doctors. It's the same quota they've had for 40 years, roughly speaking. We need an all-out assault on this. We need to massively increase supply and automate and deregulate. Listen, phone calls in 1983, the calls all of us made, add up the bill as a share of GDP. Now run that forward in time to today, sort of allowing for increases in population.
Yeah.
The bill that we would have paid dropped 91% as a share of GDP because we deregulated AT&T, we innovated, we had competition, and we had 8 major companies, not one. This absolutely can be done.
And by the way, we're starting to run out of time, Woody, but the other thing is the GDP, the gross domestic product, we may not have any. I think that's where the problem is. We're not creating anything anymore. It's being taken away, and it's being shipped off to China, to India, whatever the case may be. So we're not producing. We're getting to a point where we are at the mercy of everybody in the world except for ourselves. Now, with that, is there a website we can find you at?
Yes, AmericanGridlock.com.
Okay, AmericanGridlock.com.
And these issues, American Gridlock, one word, AmericanGridlock.com, I believe, is the book website, and then it ties into other things.
Wonderful. Hey, Woody Brock, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Keep going after them, because one way or the other, they've got to hear it.
Well, thank you, sir.
And thank you for being here. Good night.
Moment and I got a funny feeling we're parting out as friends. Your cheers and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser.
And I'm Radio Susie.
And that, my friends, is a wrap.
I would spend it with you again, but now the curtain falls. Dusty walls. People say I was made.